Politics, it's often said, is a tough game. But lost in the back and forth over policies are the lives of public servants who pay a very real toll for their service. Today's guest knows that experience better than most. She's Ambassador Susan Rice this week on Story in the Public Square. And welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, authors, journalists, scholars, and more, to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Ambassador Susan Rice, President Obama's last national security advisor, who is the author of a remarkable new memoir, Tough Love: My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. Madam Ambassador, thank you so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Jim.
So we've got about literally 3 days of conversation we want to have with you, but I want to dive right into some of the policy stuff. The Obama administration, you were national security advisor, had, I thought, three really big strategic game-changing accomplishments: the Paris Climate Accords, the Iran nuclear deal, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Since the change in government in 2017, all of those accomplishments have been undermined.
Undone by President Trump, yes.
Is there any future left for bipartisan approach to those big international issues?
Well, I think potentially, but, you know, they were not accomplished with a great deal of bipartisan support in the first place. Their undoing, however, was particularly impulsive and unstrategic, because in each of those instances there was not a viable alternative plan to advance our interests that was put out to replace the Obama administration's efforts. The one of the three that you mentioned that did have bipartisan support for a period, of course, was the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And traditionally, before the deck chairs got scrambled, there was a bipartisan coalition of Republicans on the one hand and mainly centrist Democrats on the other that favored well-conceived, highly structured trade agreements that benefited American workers and exporters, raised labor standards, and raised environmental standards, as the Trans-Pacific Partnership did. On climate, as you know, it was the first President Bush who took us into multilateral climate agreements. And I think there is, in fact, now a growing recognition, particularly among younger voters in both parties, that dealing with climate change is an absolute necessity. The Paris Agreement, as many have said, was a floor, not a ceiling.
Right.
We need to return to it with new leadership in almost the day after the next election. Otherwise, our children, our grandchildren, are going to inherit a close to uninhabitable planet.
Is it fundamentally a political challenge? I mean, you talked about sort of the next generation who sees, it maybe has a different approach to these issues than a lot of older Americans might have. Is it a political, is it a generational issue? How do we get back to some sort of, how do we build that kind of consensus to tackle these big global issues?
Well, I think they're each different, and I don't think they can be lumped together. Climate change in particular, its manifestations are becoming more and more dramatic every day. Whether you're living with fires or floods or hurricanes or the like. And I think all Americans of various ages are starting to see that something dramatic is happening and that we can't just be indifferent to it. I think it's younger voters, though, who recognize that this is going to be their planet for quite a while longer, that have a greater sense of urgency, perhaps, about it.
So in terms of climate change, do you see that as a factor in the upcoming elections next year?
I think it's growing as a factor, and again, particularly among younger voters. Historically, it's not moved the needle very much, but I think you're seeing a great deal more interest and activism on climate change, on gun issues, on a range of important challenges that are motivating and inspiring younger people.
Let's get into your book. It could have been a policy book, and that would have been, I'm sure, brilliantly done and well-read.
And boring.
How do you say that? I think it would not have been boring. But you did something more. I mean, there is certainly policy in this, some of your biography. It's a very candid, unflinching, personal, I guess I want to use the word memoir. I mean, and it's beautifully done.
Thank you.
What went into the decision to write this book as opposed to any number of other books you might have written?
Well, I really felt after leaving the Obama administration, where I had the extraordinary privilege of speaking on behalf of the United States, representing us to the world, trying to keep us safe, that I had something to say, both about who I was and the factors that shaped me, and what I'd learned. I describe in Tough Love, I come from a family that's rather unusual, descendants of slaves on the one hand, immigrants from Jamaica on the other, who each generation worked to rise and lift itself and its and others up with it. I've had an extraordinary opportunity to grow up in a Washington, D.C. in the late 60s and 70s. It looks a lot different, frankly, than the one I live in now, where families and relationships were forged across partisan lines. I grew up with that experience infused in the business and the work of Washington. And then I've had the opportunity to serve, and out of that I've learned some lessons that I think are relevant to anyone who wants to compete and thrive in unforgiving environments, and if they've been knocked down, as I have a few times, to get back up. So I wanted to share that, and I wanted to do it in my own voice, and frankly do it before others again tried to characterize me for me, which was obviously something I had to endure while I was a policymaker.
You had a little bit of experience with that, shall we say. So what are some of those lessons? And then we can dive deeper into the book.
Well, but I think
generally,
among,
what are the lessons?
Among the most important are the necessity of, as my parents taught me, to believe in yourself, even when you may be the youngest or the only woman or a minority, not to let other people's bigotry and prejudice become your own burden, your own psychological burden. And my father, who was born in segregated South Carolina in 1920 and served in a segregated Air Force during World War II at Tuskegee with the Tuskegee Airmen.
Oh, wow.
He went on to become a PhD in economics and ultimately a governor of the Federal Reserve, but only after overcoming many of the burdens and the baggage of oppressive racial prejudice in this country. And he taught me that the only way to do that is not to let the bigot's prejudice become your own definition of yourself. In other words, bigotry is, in most every instance, a product of somebody else's insecurity. And if you let their insecurity become your own, and if you let them teach you or cause you to believe that you are less, that you can't, that you're incapable or unworthy, then you'll believe that, and that will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. On the other hand, if you believe in yourself and you recognize that what they're trying to do to you in terms of your own mindset is due to their own insecurity, you can do a sort of psychological jujitsu and prevent that from becoming your own. So that's among the kind of lessons that my parents taught me. They taught me when you get knocked down, you gotta get back up. That, you know, you really have two choices in that context. Stay down and be beat down or get back up and try again. That's very, very valuable, simple as it is, but enabled me to do the many things that I've tried to do. Working hard, being committed, doing my best, not letting other people define you for you. These are all among the critical lessons that my parents taught me. And one final one, which my father hammered into me all the time, which was don't take crap off of anybody. In other words, don't let very direct but very real. Don't let anybody bully you, dismiss you, denigrate you. And if they do, you have to push back. You can't take crap.
You talk about the D.C. that you grew up in and sort of this, where there were the social relationships across political parties. People were actually friendly with one another beyond whatever their labels were.
Friends, not just friendly.
Right. And kids played in Little League together and spouses knew each other and socialized with each other. That D.C. by and large, has ceased to exist. Is that part of the reason why the politics is so strident today and people are?
I think it's one of the many reasons. Yeah. The Washington I grew up in was, you know, an elite Washington, quite frankly. I was very fortunate by virtue of my parents' hard work and relative success to be able to attend exclusive private schools in Washington, D.C. And I was one of very few African Americans in those schools. But my classmates and friends were, in many instances, the sons and daughters of members of Congress or ambassadors or other government officials. And it was a time when, you know, this is before cable. This is where we got our, I don't know if, well, our viewers will remember when Walter Cronkite and two other older white men gave us our nightly news in very straight servings every night. It was a time when there was no social media. And members of Congress moved their families to Washington and lived in Washington, D.C., rather than on cots in their congressional offices or in flop houses with other members from their own parties. And so where your kids go to school together, where they forge friendships that cause the parents to forge friendships, when the parents see each other on the golf course or in a cocktail party or wherever it is, they have human relationships.
Yeah.
And it's a lot harder to fight with and dislike people that you know well.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at J.M. Lutis. Joining me as he does every week in the co-host chair is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books, including the recently published Kid Number One. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Ambassador Susan Rice, former National Security Advisor to President Barack Obama and author of a candid new memoir of her life and service. It's titled Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. You can follow Ambassador Rice on Twitter at Ambassador Rice. So contrast that with the divisiveness that we have today. I'm curious, you put your national security hat back on for a second. How much of a liability is that divisiveness to America's national security?
It's huge. And I write about this at some length in the last chapter of Tough Love. The chapter is called Bridging the Divide. And in it, I argue that our domestic political divisions are, in my estimation, our greatest national security vulnerability right now. And I say that for several reasons. One, these divisions are preventing us from getting even the most basic things done that we need to do to remain competitive in the 21st century. We can't invest in infrastructure. We can't prepare to our young people, our workers, and students to be maximally competitive in an environment that's going to be highly technical and revolve around things like artificial intelligence, because we can't agree on the kinds of initiatives and proposals and investments that are necessary to do so. So we're allowing our competitors a jump, but also our adversaries, for instance, the Russians, most deliberately and clearly, recognize our divisions and understand that they can weaken us, if not defeat us, without firing a bullet, simply by working methodically as they are to exacerbate our domestic political division. So on every divisive issue, race, immigration, gay rights, guns, you name it, they are very actively working through social media and actually through overt media to pit Americans against each other and cause us to hate and distrust each other more than ever. And that is precisely what they began to do, as many Americans became aware in the 2016 election, but they're doing it every day since, and will continue to do so. And because these are our divisions, you know, they have figured out how to pour salt in our wounds and cause us
Well, they've been very smart about it.
They've been very smart.
They understand our culture.
And they have been very smart. They understand our culture better than we think they do.
Yes.
And you know, I think Americans haven't built up the kinds of resiliency and defense mechanisms to understand in the first instance what is happening to us, how our adversaries are playing this role, and then to be far more responsible and educated consumers of the information that they digest.
Do you think we've reached a point where the divisions and the disagreements and the gap cannot be bridged?
No, I think it can.
How?
And I say that, well, let me say first why I think that.
Okay,
and then
sure.
How we can do it.
I want the answer right now. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I really think it's important that as divisive as this moment is, and as deep as our divisions feel, and they are, Americans, I think, need to look back over the span of our history and recognize we've been through so much worse than this. We've been through a civil war, Reconstruction, two world wars, McCarthyism, Vietnam, our cities burning down during the civil rights era. We have come through each of those periods of far greater division and stress, arguably stronger, and certainly whole. And so we have a capacity to change, to grow, to renew, to heal divisions. We've proved that time and time again. And so I, for one, am unwilling to bet against our ability to do so again. It's not the nature of our history. It's not the nature of our culture. But how do we do it? I think there are many steps we need to take, from the individual level to the macro national level. I write in Tough Love about the challenges we face in my own family. We have real political divisions in my own family. I've got a very conservative son who would describe himself as a traditional Reagan Republican, which actually was a relief that he recently said that. I was like, okay, I got you.
Was there
I got
a big
that.
Moment when he revealed that to you?
It's actually last night. Over dinner in California.
Oh, wow.
Before I got on the red eye to come see you all. But anyway, he's quite conservative. Mm-hmm. And we have a daughter who's quite progressive. And my husband and I are, you know, we would call ourselves pragmatists, and for the most part, liberals, but pragmatists. And so we really are sitting at our dinner table like this, you know, trying to keep the food from flying across the table. And yet, as much as we disagree on policy issues and politics, we love each other very much, and we are consciously and deliberately committed to keeping our family whole and not allowing these divisions to undo us, even as they can lead to some pretty intense arguments.
I learned long ago not to argue with you, but...
but he's going to try.
my concern...
That's just on a personal level. I want to get to the larger scale, but go ahead.
So I think that's where I'm interested, too, because if we push that analogy, the father in this country right now is provoking those divisions as well as our external adversaries.
I don't think of him as our father.
But the President of the United States,
is stoking those
divisions just as assuredly as our foreign adversaries are. And I can't think of a corollary in American history to give me confidence that there's not going to be so much damage done that we're going to be a different country by the time he's no longer president.
Well, I think you're right about the fact that what Trump is doing in terms of stoking, fueling, exacerbating divisions is, at least in our lifetime, unprecedented. And I think the damage is real. I don't seek to minimize that. And I am not at all Pollyannish about the severity of the challenge we face and the necessity for there to be change quickly. I don't think we've got, frankly, 5 years.
Yeah.
But I think if we make an urgent and immediate change in 2020, that we have the potential to build back, to recognize that, you know, at the end of the day, as Americans, just like in a family, we have more that unites us than divides us. And, you know, if any of us in the aggregate decide at some point that's not true, then we just won't be the United States of America.
Right.
You know, we will disintegrate in some form or fashion. And I don't exclude that as a possibility. I just don't think it's a probability. And I think, you know, that in addition to what President Trump has done, what concerns me is, frankly, that he's been supported and enabled thus far by others in his party who have also found value, political value, in exacerbating divisions. But I don't think that's what the bulk of the American people want. And I think it's frankly interesting that even leaving aside the extremes on both sides, that most Americans still are interested in playing, you know, within the 30-yard line, so to speak, on either sides of the field. And when you look at their perspectives and opinions on critical issues, most of them are not in the far fringes. And so what we need is responsible leadership. We've had that not in the distant past, and we can have it again. And it needs to be, frankly, not just in the White House, but in Congress, yes, in both parties.
So one of the things that I loved about the book is that I thought it was incredibly humanizing of people who you maybe hear about in the news, maybe folks have watched on CNN or on C-SPAN, but there's a shared existence when you're working in these high-level, high-pressure jobs that I thought you actually captured. I was surprised, I mentioned this to you in the green room, by the number of references to dance parties. But this is very human.
It's my unique style of leadership.
So talk to us,
and
though.
And President Obama's, actually, but that's a different.
But talk to us and explain to our audience sort of like the human dynamics of these sort of super intense teams and these experiences.
Well, when you're working under extraordinary pressure, as one does when you work on national security in the White House, or frankly work on any set of issues in the White House, you really live or die by the people that you are there with, whether you can trust them, whether you want to be with them, whether you can, you know, find your way to having fun with them. I actually really feel very sorry for the people who are working in the current White House, which is like a snake pit where everybody's stabbing each other in the back and they don't trust each other, and they're leaking about each other. And it's just, these jobs are really hard.
Even in a perfect environment.
In a perfect environment.
Yeah.
And, you know, through all of the challenges that we faced in the Obama administration, I never worried that the person down the hall or in the office next door was out to get me or wasn't going to have my back when I needed it most. And so that's an extraordinary blessing. I think it's, you know, largely a function of the kinds of people that President Obama selected. It's also a function of the tone he set at the top. He had no tolerance for that kind of backstabbing and drama, as he used to call it. But, you know, beyond that, to this day, the people that I worked most closely with in the White House are my close friends. And, you know, when I think about who I want to hang out with and celebrate with, those are the people.
It's
and
the,
we
the,
will
the crucible
we
experience.
Will be dancing.
Yes. You talked about 2020 with, I think you used the term urgency or urgent, and then you used the term disintegrate. So what did you mean by that? Or what if there's not change of the sort you're describing in 2020, what do you mean by disintegrate?
What
in
I
terms
mean
of
is,
the country,
I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, if.
What could happen?
What I'm saying is that we have these persistent and serious divisions. They are being actively exacerbated mm-hmm. now, both by the current leadership and by our external adversaries. And I think a question is to what extent they're working in tandem or not. But however you answer that question, the longer that persists unchecked, I think the harder it is for us to heal. I don't think it's impossible, but I think that, you know, we have lost a lot in terms of mutual trust, national cohesion, and certainly global leadership. The sooner we are about the business of trying to rectify that, the less the damage there is to repair, in my judgment. But I'm not saying that, you know, that literally the country falls apart. I don't exclude that possibility, but I think it's very, very unlikely. I think more likely is that the distrust deepens and that our willingness to be open to the views and the perspectives of others becomes even more diminished. You asked about, I want to get back to the question, what do we do about it,
yeah.
right? I
yeah.
think I think there are a whole range of things, starting with longer-term investments in how we educate our children. We don't teach civics education anymore.
No, that's so true.
Nowhere.
No, it's true.
People don't learn about the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and the separation of powers, and that freedom of expression doesn't mean you can't say things that might offend me. I mean, kids go to college now and are completely intolerant of dissenting views on campus. You know, if a speaker's coming that they disagree with, they may rip down the posters rather than go and have a robust debate and engage an alternative point of view. So there's a whole lot we can do with respect to how we teach ourselves to engage with difference and dissent. The political structure, our political system, is also now designed to reward extremes, whether how we district our congressional races, how we have allowed money of all forms that is completely unaccountable now to flow into our system. Our primary process, it rewards extremes. An alternative might be something of the sort they now have in the state of Maine, which is called ranked choice voting, mm-hmm. where you actually don't just go in and vote for one person. You rank the people on the ballot in order of your preference. And whoever gets the least amount of votes, if nobody has broken 50%, the votes of the lowest vote getter get redistributed in order of the voter's preference. And so what that means is, imagine if you're a Democrat, you go into the ballot booth or the polling booth, and you got to pick. So you pick the Democrats, maybe. Maybe you pick the Republican next or the Independent, depending on who you think would be the next best and the next best. And that means that you actually end up often with less extreme candidates. So those are among the kinds of political reforms. And then ultimately, I also think we need to consider mandatory national service for young people 18 to 22 in this country.
That's a huge idea, and we could talk to you for three more days, but we're out of time. Ambassador Susan Rice, the book is Tough Love. It is absolutely worth your read. That is all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.